Hey, Mayor. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
How are you? I want to thank you all also echoing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to ask you about your views on the pick. So, I mean, I hope you're prepared with deep insight.
Unlike Ed Rendell, I'm not an expert.
I think it was a compliment. There's nothing complimentary about that. I want a quick plug. This space we're in, PHL Next Stage, Drexel and Brandywine Partnership, that's extending part of the School of the Arts. It's part of a lot of changes in the city. Lots of questions I want to dive into, but one of the ones that I think is most interesting, we've gotten a check-in the last couple of years, really appreciate that. Right after you were elected, we had a conversation. Last Philly Tech Week did this first. This ends up being a nice annual check on how you're viewing technology, entrepreneurship, innovation policy. So maybe kick us off with a wider lens. A lot of things happening, things like school yards, but within your administration, what are you seeing as interesting? What are you proud of over the last maybe year and a half in your effort around these issues?
Well, first of all, I think you're sitting at the epicenter of what the innovation space in front of you is going to look like in the future, in the long-term future. I mean, and this whole area is bubbling now and will continue to bubble with the type of investment and the type of opportunities to bring in companies, to grow companies here, for startups and for folks already in existence. I think that Drexel
are
moving this in the right direction. And then Comcast, how will be done, kind of because Blue Cross is getting into innovation space also, and I just think it's a great opportunity for our residents who live here now, our young people who will be growing up, and that's why we need to make sure that they have the capacity and the opportunities to improve their skills and to get into this space. So I will tell you, one of the things, I went to South by Southwest for the first time and did not stay for the music portion, just stayed for the tech portion. The one thing that I noticed immediately stood out for me is the lack of diversity. I mean, it is not diverse at all, and it's no fault of South by Southwest. It's fault of I guess, us who are leaders in government to make sure that we bring more people of diverse nature into the tech space. Because our kids our kids are really smart, and they will pick it, they will pick stuff up. I watched the folks from Coded by Kids, Sylvester Mowgli, and you heard of it?
Yeah.
Sylvester, I was watching work with our young people, and Sylvester has volunteered, and they just, they thrive with it, they move towards it, and they embrace it. And if we can get our children the opportunity from a very early age to be involved with the tech world, I think we'll be a less poor city in the next generation. Maybe watch a 4-year-old play with a tablet. It dizzies me to think about that 4-year-old when they're 24. That's astronomical as the abilities that they'll gather and gain within the course of that.
So that's relevant indeed. Right after this conversation, we have a handful of leaders from throughout the Mid-Atlantic talking about what lessons Philadelphia and other communities can grasp from economic development that can impact lots of communities.
But you have to bring that tech to the playground, to the rec center, to the school, to the library, because that's where they'll go. You can't expect them to find it themselves. You have to bring it to them, because a lot of our neighborhoods, sad to say, are struggling, and the people who are living there are wonderful people, but they happen to be poor. And when you're poor, you don't have access to a lot of things. I mean, look at the percentage of folks in our city that don't have access to the internet. I mean, the internet is like, it's like having access to a book. I mean, there are books. I mean, when you get to that level, you're not going to, people are not going to be able to improve their situation in life unless we make the investment and we bring the tools to the places where people are so that the kids can develop them.
What are you seeing, given all the constraints you have, what is your role in doing that work?
Well, our rebuild program. I mean, obviously, look, whether you like the Philadelphia Beverage Tax or you don't, it's here. I don't think it's been that terribly detrimental. I mean, I know the big soda companies are trying to twist the tax into some economic, H-bomb that's going to put them all out of business all of a sudden. Coca-Cola had a bad quarter and they laid off 1,200 people. I don't think it had anything to do with the beverage tax nationwide, because it's only here in Philadelphia and in Berkeley. So I think they're using it as an excuse. Obviously, they're suing us, and we're tied up in state court. We've been to Commonwealth Court, and we'll probably be at the Supreme Court sometime at the end of the summer or in the fall. But it was a necessity, because I can't find revenue anyplace else. There is no governmental entity in Harrisburg or Washington that wants to fund education. They don't think that it's a requirement. They think it's a luxury. And I don't believe it's a luxury. I think it's an absolute requirement. With a city with a 26% poverty rate, education is the only key, one of the major keys, not the only, but one of the major keys to moving people from poverty into middle class. And if you're paying a few more pennies on your, and I'll give you a good example, not to get off on the beverage tax, but this young guy comes up to me last a couple weeks ago and says, "I really like you, and I really like what you're doing, but you cost me a dollar more on my 16-ounce soda." I said, "Well, it's only a quarter, so go back to the store you bought it from and tell them you ripped you off the 75 cents." But that's what's happening. They're jacking up prices, they're scaring people, they're blaming people, they're taxing things like Tabasco sauce and seltzer, I mean, milk, lots of stuff. That, anyway, we'll work our way through it. But the issue is that money creates our ability to borrow $300 million in city-funded capital money, and then it generated $100 million for William Penn, the William Penn Foundation, and God bless them, because they're our life, they're the lifeline to the city after Pew moved up to New York. It's $100 million, and then that's $400 million, and it allows us to leverage from other governments and other philanthropy another $100 million. That's $500 million in public investment in parks and recreation centers and libraries. And why we need to do that is because they're falling down. In many of our rec centers in our neighborhoods are 90, 100 years old. They haven't had a major renovation in 34 years. The plaster's falling out of the ceiling. The basketball courts are like this. There's no workspace. There's no tech space. It's just we need to get them up to this current standard, a good standard. And that's the space where our kids can win with government assistance, with private sector assistance, and with volunteerism to learn to become facile with tech.
A quick push there, though. I mean, any additional funding for the school district likely isn't going to result in, coding programs and technology in the hands of kids. So maybe push that forward a bit more. And if you think that one of the fundamental differences is lack of access for underserved communities in technology sectors, is there something that you think that you can play a role in, given the constraints you have?
Well, I mean, I think that when we create spaces that are attractive, and where young people and not so young people want to be in, we can then have a captive audience to then bring in the resources on the tech side to get people, paying attention to this and learning from it. I mean, obviously, the earlier you start with children and tech, the better off you're going to be. I mean, it's hard for somebody who's not been involved with tech to get there. Mm. But if we do it with our children early through pre-K and through improving our school climate, there's no appetite in Harrisburg to improve the funding situation for our schools. So my alternative is just like wring my hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do. Or we go out and find areas of revenue like the beverage tax that we can invest in our children and our neighborhoods.
You're describing one of the big political fights you've had. I was very taken when we talked in December 2015, right after elected, before you came into office. You joked that you wanted to be mayor-elect forever because very presciently you knew, governing is always harder than campaigning after a coalition builder.
Like Donald Trump. It's harder than you think.
That's where I'm leading, to be honest.
No, I just think that what happens is that, for example, I mean, I'll give you the NFL draft, for example, right? Let me go back to the DNC. There was somebody made a we didn't. Somebody made a projection of what the DNC was going to generate, and the number was $130 million less than was estimated. However, in 4 days, the city brought in $230 million. The headline is "City falls short of projections." All right, yeah, well, $230 million isn't exactly chicken feed either. So, why can't it be the city generated $230 million because of the DNC investment? When you go to the NFL draft, which I was honestly didn't know if it was going to work. I didn't know what was going to happen. And the biggest thing that happened, in addition to, I think, the $80 million or so, and every hotel room was filled, every restaurant, I was riding down Fairmount Avenue and Spring Garden, on the sidewalks outside bars and restaurants. But the most important thing, I think, that the draft did, everybody was nice to each other. I don't know if you were there, but it was like, man, it's like, Dallas fans were like, we're talking to Eagles fans and getting pictures with them. It was this nice family, grandparent, father, mother, sons, daughters, kind of thing. And it was just, it was a kind of a beautiful happening thing. Even if the first round of the draft was over and the excitement about the Eagles picks and others, and then you get into the other rounds, it's not that, you know, that exciting on that level. But all the experiential stuff that was going on the Parkway was fabulous. But you still have complaints, and understandable complaints from people who live around there. You have understandable complaints from, you know, people who drive in and, you know, can't, you know, it takes them longer to drive in. So I said, I wish I could be mayor-elect forever, because I hadn't made any decisions yet to make anybody mad. So it's kind of a balance that way. But you have to learn not to take everything to heart. You have to learn not to read the comment section of Philly.com.
We've already learned that a long time ago.
Well, the problem is my mother reads it.
Has your mom commented about that?
No, my mother has called me, and like some of the things that are alleged on there, they're like, "My mother, are you okay?" And, "Yes, I'm fine." That is one of the most.
Does mom worry about you, honestly?
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
That is one of the most detrimental things in journalism I've ever seen. Is a comment page that's anonymous. It's anonymous and unmonitored, and they do it because all the clicks determine the rates for advertising. Which I think is not a good reason to allow people to say scurrilous things about somebody's mother or you know, brother, wife. You know.
There's been many attempts to make that better. I have to give that love. But I'm so like
you
your mom.
You have to put your name on it.
Well,
you just have to put your own name on it. Not, you know, not.
We're not going
to
solve online commenting.
Not sleazy river rat from South Philly. Just put your name on it. So I put my name on stuff. Put your name on it.
I like the thread. Mom, we also have talked about one of your proudest and interesting moments was that, you know, you grew up here. There was a pride that you are, you know, mayor. Maybe talk a little bit about what has mom seen.
Well, they live in New Jersey. they live in a senior community. Nothing wrong with senior communities, but I could never live in a senior community. I can't live with everybody my own age. It's not fun. I need 90-year-olds and 20-year-olds and everybody in between. That's why Rittenhouse Square is probably one of the most iconic spaces in the city, because it's everybody's park and everybody goes there. And it's like you could see all kinds of homeless people and rich people. It's like everybody in between, which is kind of cool. Mm. So, but growing up in the city and becoming mayor, my father's a firefighter, so I was always proud of him in his service to the city, and I was always proud that he was a firefighter, and was always wanted to go to the station when he wasn't working, and he had to pick up his check or something, or do paperwork, and we'd play all the apparatus, and we'd steal candy from the canteen, and all that. It's all just fun stuff. And the first time I was ever in City Hall in my life, I believe I was around 8 or 9 years old, and my father was being promoted to lieutenant, and Frank Rizzo swore him in. And that was the first time I'd actually been in the mayor's reception room. So when I did my first press conference in there, it was quite impactful for me.
Legendary Mayor Frank Rizzo.
I just got elected, and I'm walking down the street in South Philly, and this lady yells across the street, "The next Frank Rizzo!" And I went, "No, I don't want to do that." Strove not to be that, yes.
One of the threads we've had when we've
talked... How do you think he'd be on Sanctuary City?
I... would love to see the debate, you and Frankie, on Sanctuary Cities. Well, I mean, let's take that for a second. So Sanctuary Cities, obviously pressure's building a little bit. Where are you?
Let me tell you a South by Southwest story.
Yeah.
Young man comes up to me, did a panel on immigration, and we're changing the nomenclature, because apparently sanctuary is now a pejorative word. Safe and holy is that bad. We don't want to be a safe and holy city. It's a bad thing. So we're upholding the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution, which I took an oath to uphold, which means that we can't hold people in jail without a charge or without a warrant. Simple. Go get a warrant, and we'll turn a guy over. But if you want me to hold somebody for 2-3 days, like we're holding families, no, we are, but are holding families in the Berks County Detention Center for 18, 20, 22 months with no charges or nothing. I mean, that's not America. It is America, because we did the Japanese, and you know, we've done it to other folks in our history, but shouldn't we learn from the mistakes that we're making?
Do you think you'll hold that line if the funding conversations get serious about other federal state fundings being derailed because of sanctuary city?
Right now, well, let me tell you the text side story. A young man comes up to me and says he's from India. He got his undergraduate degree in New Delhi and his graduate degree in New Delhi, and he came to the United States to study at Penn to get his master's degree in robotics. In the meantime, his sister who lives here had a premature baby and was in the NICU unit at CHOP. And apparently, when mom goes home and the baby can't go home, she must pump breast milk in order for the baby to get stronger. When children have their own mother's breast milk, they do get stronger, especially when they're NICU. And he noticed that the nurses were having a horrible time with trying to figure out keeping everything and whose milk was whose and what baby was gone. And they spent a lot of time cataloging stuff. He comes up with this idea that through robotics and through barcoding, he starts a company that takes care of all that. So when the milk gets delivered to the hospital, it's already coded, it knows what room to go in, and the nurses can be nurses and not be stock clerks. Ice comes to him and says, you have to go. You have to leave because you're overstayed your student visa. He said, I'm rolling out my company in 2 months. We really don't care. You got to get out of here. So he, thank God he had a partner who is, an American, or at least not, or at least green card holder, I think he's an American. He was able to stay and help roll the company out. He had to get on the plane and fly back to New Delhi. He said, how long is it going to take? He said, we don't know. It could be 4 months, 4 years. We don't care. And that's, he got back, and he's fine. He's back here now. He's all settled. Why would you want to invest here? Why would you want to send your kid to school here? When, just north of the border, is Canada, who has a handsome prime minister and an open border in healthcare. So I want to invest in the United States because Donald, well, I like him.
Are you going to hold that line if the funding conversation gets serious?
Well, I
got to
see how much it is, and I got to see where they want to take it. We have a lot of lawyers that are, you know, working, some of them working pro bono, and some are outside counsel, plus our city solicitor's office. They believe there needs to be a nexus between the funding and what we're not doing that they want us to do. Now, let's think about the stupidness of this whole thing. I don't agree, first of all, and the other problem with this immigration debate is it lays at the feet of every immigrant crime. So the narrative that they're doing now is that every immigrant, documented or undocumented, bring crime and rape and murder to our city, our country. Well, we have the lowest crime rate in 40 years. And we've been a Fourth Amendment city for a number of years now. So it's not like all these wild-eyed immigrants are out there stabbing and raping people. I mean, they want to go to work and be left alone, basically. So if you stipulate this for a moment that that's the case, let's defund the police, because crime is so bad because of immigrants, and if you keep protecting these immigrants, we're going to take money away from the cops. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So I don't know if they're able to do it. Thank God for the federal courts, because it's the only thing between us and totalitarianism. I mean, he started talking about, you know, these judges, they're in the way, the Constitution's in the way. I mean, in the way, really? In the way of what? He's bringing the guy from the Philippines to the, he's talking nice about world dictators. I mean, it's crazy stuff. But my point is that I can't and I won't throw our immigrant population under the bus for political benefit. I'm just not doing it. And I've come a long way on this immigrant issue, because when I started this in 1999, before 9/11, I was getting a lot of pushback from people who were third, fourth generation Irish immigrants and refugees. I mean, where do you think we came from? We were starving to death, crawled off coffin ships, and went to New York, Boston, and Philadelphia, and Baltimore, and nobody wanted us here either. They burned two churches down in 1844 in July, St. Augustine's and St. Philip and St. Michael's in Kensington. They tried to burn down St. Philip Neri's in Queen Village, and were fought back by the Pennsylvania Guards. And this is nothing new to us. I mean, if you don't respect your own history and the negativity and the nativist attitude and the know-nothing attitude that was put against you, and you want me to do the same thing to somebody from the Middle East or from Africa or from, no, I ain't, I'm not, or Mexico, I'm not doing that. So we got to figure out if they're real, if they have some plan to take specific money, how much, and, you know, can we afford it or not? And then we got to figure out what we got to do to adjust. But I'm not going to just capitulate because Jeff Sessions gets on television and makes a threat.
I want to turn to some policy, some local policy as well. In February, Commerce Department announces Gateway Philly. It's a per seat program to help aimed at encouraging luring in suburban companies to open satellite offices here. I want to talk a little bit about strategy there, what you're seeing. Obviously, considerably early days, but talk a little bit about what you've seen so far.
It's called young, talented people who don't want to live in the suburbs. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, really is. I mean, I think Mount Vernon's wonderful. I think it's beautiful, and it's horse country, and I like to visit it. I don't know if I necessarily want to live there. And not because it's not a nice place to live, but it's just not convenient to the lifestyle that I like and enjoy. And I think the same thing happens with the young talent in some of these finance companies and tech companies and others, that they want to be in the city, and they want to not have a car, and they want to ride their bike safely, and they want hip stuff to do, and they want restaurants and stuff to recreate, and they want nice parks, and they want to walk their dog, and I mean...
And there's already a supply of companies coming in to start that, right? We already saw, because there was a movement of young people, companies have begun. This is obviously meant to push up the demand for it. So maybe,
for example, Vanguard. I mean, it's a stately, terrific company that's been around for a long time, and it's got a lot of stability and great reputation, and they've decided to take a chance with us and bring some folks in here. And I think that is a... And the other thing is, we've been also holding on to companies that had a possibility of coming. Aramark was a huge retention for us. I mean, and they were, they were seriously looking at other space. I mean, we're working... There's a company that's well-known that we may be possibly bringing in, but I can't tell you who it is. They're in the suburbs now. But it's really having your commerce department and all your city departments coordinate correctly through PID, with PIDC and some of the other agencies that can help with finance, space, and paying maybe months of rent in advance or a year of rent in advance, and giving those incentives. We found also that trying to balance the Navy Yard and its kind of suburban campus feel in the city, some companies don't want that either. They want to be downtown. Some people want to have to be in the Navy Yard area, or some people are going to want to be out here. And many people are going to be out here at Schuylkill Yards and some of the other innovative places. And then you go through like Northern Liberties and Fishtown and even Kensington now, and you start seeing these small companies popping. East Market Street, Old City, Nerd Street, and a lot of these places are just, they happen on their own to a degree.
Right.
And they really don't, a lot of them really don't need or want a lot of incentive. But what they want is access to information. Mm-hmm. And that's those data dumps we do, and those data sets we release. That is more exciting to young companies like that than any kind of financial subsidy. They don't talk about the wage tax.
Right.
I mean, we're continuing to reduce the wage tax and business taxes. We've been doing it since 19, for the Rendell administration, started with the reduction in wage and business. They're small incremental reductions, but they're going in the right direction. The only time they stopped and were frozen were a couple years during another administration where the recession was kicked in, and then we started ramping them up again. But those young folks don't even talk about wage and business taxes. They need access to information. I mean, when we released all the city salaries of every employee in the city, you think we, like, it was the holy grail, like here, or information on L&I, or information on health violations, or parking authorities. I mean, all that kind of information. And I finally learned that, because government people are generally resistant to that kind of exposure of information. People were concerned about their salaries being out there and stuff like that. I think I've learned, thankfully, that the more information we put in this environment, the more ideas we'll get and how to fix the stuff that's wrong, and the more stable companies become, because they can manipulate that information for their own business and their own business model and their own advertising approach. So that we're going to continue to put that information out fast and as much as we can.
So I want to do a little more on open data, but a thread there that I think is important, that on Gateway Philly as an example, there was a relationship that every government has to make a philosophical decision on, whether we want to use incentives or otherwise to really pull people in, or we'll use our natural assets to do that, with a movement of young people, talent being the attractant. And I'm kind of curious about your philosophical view about how much does government have to play an active role, in addition to, unrelated to reducing wage tax, having a great place to live, but those dollars, right, like the $1,000 per head, up to 20 to bring in Gateway Philly. I'm curious about that decision to try to, put more than just the talent as the attractor.
I think it's on a case by case basis. It's based on the leadership of the company, how old the company is, whether or not they think those kind of incentives are things that are attractive to them, or every company's different. And every company wants something different. Every company makes decisions on location or relocation based on their own company and their own leadership and their CEO, where the CEO wants to live, and those kinds of things. So from my perspective, Gateway Philly will allow the CEO to live in the suburbs, where near near the business park where their company's located, but also allow them to shoot some of their younger people into the city, into an office building or into the Navy Yard or someplace, or Schuylkill, that will allow that portion of the company to grow.
Mm. Let's do a little more on data then. One of the big changes coming in your administration was to move what essentially was the Open Data Office out of IT and over to administration, a little closer to the executive and chief data officer, Tim Wisniewski, is here.
Here's the problem. Yeah. It's not a problem. Here's the situation. Feel free to speak up at this. His group is like a young, you know, innovative kind of group that wants innovation, right? Problem is the bones of the system were rotting, if they existed at all.
City IT infrastructure.
So, and that's not sexy stuff. That's grunt work. And I think what we did was we allowed that group to continue their innovative thought while we continue to fix, with their help, the bones and the structure of it. I mean, and I've said this is sad, but it's true. If L and I, not a few years ago when we had that building collapse, 22nd floor.
License and inspections.
License and inspections could have talked to revenue through technology, the permit would have never been issued. Because everybody involved in getting the permit owed back taxes.
Are we closer to being able to do that today?
Yes, we are closer. We're closer, but we're not there yet. What now, we acknowledge the fact that you have to come and get a clearance certificate from revenue that you're. But my point is, all these.
To make sure you're not backed up on taxes, essentially.
Or, no, if you're backed up on taxes, you're probably cutting corners. Because you're backed up on taxes. So, I mean, if you have multiple L&I violations, or you have other issues, if they can communicate with each other quickly, then you can public safety is enhanced. But other than that, our ability to collect our taxes. I mean, Alan Dahm is back there. He's one of our councilmen at large. I mean, he's been on us from day one on collection of back real estate taxes, business taxes, and he's right. The key was the other issue is one of the tech investment. Because I was on the board of a big company, and I don't want to say that who they are, but not because I'm embarrassed. I love them, but the point is, I was on the board of a big company, and we went through this whole platform change. And we started, you go down the road, and you start investing money, and you start investing money, you get halfway through, and now you can't go back, and you got to go forward, and maybe there's more money now that's necessary to be put into the project. And then when you finally get to the end, and you go, and you like hold your breath and put the switch, and you hope it all works. The problem with city government is we don't have the resources of a private sector company to do that. And if we mess up, we're all in trouble, which we've messed up. Well, we haven't messed up yet. There's been some mess ups in the past. We're trying to correct. But it's trying to get an old city that is set in its ways governmentally to look and think differently than what they're used to. Because change frightens people. When we first did 311, man, it was a struggle. And this is before I became mayor. People were in their call centers, in their offices, very comfortable to be where they were, hidden from anybody else. And when you try to bring everybody in together and put them in one room with an electronic board up there saying 15 calls waiting, average call time, I mean, people were freaking out. I mean, they were freaking out. And we finally got that stabilized now, but it's a cultural change. Mm. And it's hard to change a culture if you're have minimal investment that you need to make. So every time you make a decision, investment's got to be right. Mm-hmm. You can't have time to play around. And we're getting there. And I think that our IT folks are trying to fix those bones with everybody and Tim, and trying to all work together to get it done.
And you mentioned Councilman Dahm. One of Councilman Dahm's frequent pushes is the importance of those tech jobs, other highly educated jobs, being a great multiplier effect. They create spin-off other jobs. And one challenge that you have in developing a technology community in what is at its core still a poor city that has challenges is a challenge around prioritization. If you focus on some of your best educated residences, I feel like you're ignoring or not prioritizing those who are most at need. You ran on a campaign of populism around many groups being part. I wonder how you're getting better at threading that needle about being able to talk to the most competitive knowledge workers that can work and anywhere they want, and a population that still desperately needs help. I wonder how you're threading that line and seeing that.
Well, I mean, we're doing better with company. Like Comcast has been very helpful in the key spot stuff and getting rec centers, getting them up on the internet and libraries. And also we've been working with, like, for example, the project that we did with the health department, the library, and CHOP at Braun and Morris in South Philadelphia is a perfect example of a public-private partnership that just really enhanced everybody. I mean, we have a state-of-the-art facility. You know, CHOP has a medical clinical facility there, brand new library, and the health department has brand new office space. And they all can now coordinate together with the needs of the people coming into that building, which many of them are poor and many of them are immigrants, some documented, some not. We don't even ask, you know, we don't ask for information on their documentation. We just take care of their needs. And within that space, you have people that are applying for work through because they don't have computers at home, so they need to use computers in the library. You have people getting computer training there, and you're getting people's healthcare needs met. So those kinds of collaborations, I think, are the best way in reaching everybody. And then also Broad and Mars is a neighborhood that is becoming more affluent because there's more younger people moving in, the housing values are going up. East Patchogue Avenue is a mecca for restaurant and other types of businesses. I mean, it's where people want to live, but also there's a lot of poor people still living there.
Mm.
So it's doing those things with private and institutions and private sector companies.
Just a note, you guys can throw out questions you want using PW17 hashtag. I'm getting some of those and texted over to me. So feel free to tweet a question, hashtag PTW17. So one of those, to plug the idea of tossing out questions from the audience, you mentioned diversity, people of color being included in the technology community and that being an increasing priority. Talk a little bit about how you think the City Hall can help reach people of color, especially young black men with hidden aptitude for tech and design. Just curious, you probably have a platform, maybe share how you could think you can
after
do that.
I'm trying to figure out what we can do in Philadelphia to kind of address this issue. And one of the ideas that we're working on now and trying to flesh out is a conference next year that's a tech conference that's focused on people of color. And I want to call it the North Star Conference because Frederick Douglass' paper was the North Star. And I just think it harkens back to a time where people were running towards freedom, but now people running towards economic independence and economic freedom. And I went to a conference that I also went out to. It was very interesting. I went out to St. Louis and met with Dave Stewart. Dave Stewart is the primary owner of a company called Worldwide Technology. It's the largest African-American business in the country. He did $10 billion in gross sales last year. And this is one of the people I go out and I try to talk to, bringing a few 20 or so jobs from his company to Philadelphia. Because not only does he get tech, does he get business, is he extremely wealthy, but he has a mission, a social mission, that he wants to help universities, schools, and I think we get those kinds of folks included in our Chamber of Commerce. I think we'll have a better base of companies that really understand that you need to give back a little bit to people so they can come forward. And he was just a fascinating guy. So we want to try to do this conference and start it out in a sustainable way and bring in folks who want to be involved in the tech sector and have no, method or door to get through. And we don't know where, maybe the convention center or something like that. We're working on the details now. I don't want to replicate South by Southwest. I don't think you can. You try to do it.
I agree with that.
So I think this North Star Conference, I think it start out to be something that would be impactful in this space where people are underrepresented.
Another thread that stands out to me a lot in this balance we have of Philadelphia that is surging, including City Hall, that is talking about transparent efforts you've alluded to. I was struggling in preparation leading up to this to ignore, we have a district attorney that's been indicted on corruption charges. We are still a city that has a reputation, believe it or not, in less than savory transparent figures. Can you talk a little bit about, should a community of incredibly mobile knowledge workers accept the status quo of what we have still in the leadership?
But it doesn't change automatically. It doesn't change by osmosis. It changes when people get involved in it. I mean, and I recognize that all the new, and you have to understand whether you have to make a decision for yourself whether you want to be involved in the business or in the profession of politics or government, because it's a totally different. It's a totally different direction than when you're going to the private sector. I mean, the private sectors, you start a company, your main goal is to be profitable, or you're not going to be in business. Profit is not the main the driver of government. You should be efficient, you should not waste money, but it's people's happiness and people's well-being that is what the result of what you're supposed to be doing. And it's not people, like when people say to me, I want to run government like a business. Well, you really can't, because first of all, you don't own the business. And you can't direct this person or that person to do this or that, because you have a city council and you have other folks that are involved and you have people with opinions, and it's a democracy. You can't, you know, companies sometimes are can be a bit dictatorial. And if you're the owner of that company, and this is my capital, it's my money, I'm going to do it the way I want to do it. You can't run government like that. And it's the same thing with Trump. You know, bring an outsider. Drain the swamp and bring an outsider. Well, if you don't know anything about it, it's like going to a dentist who'd never been a dentist before. And he's going to get a lot of smart people around you in a chair to tell him where to drill. Well, I don't want that. Or if you bring the smart people who know government, listen to them. I don't have, every idea is not mine. And I'm not the smartest person in the room. Now or generally ever. So I got to listen to folks. I will make a collaborative decision, or if I'm a tiebreaker, I'll make the tiebreaker. But if everything we do is collaborative, it's not, you know, I go in every day and issue orders. I mean, I love when he signs the executive orders and turns around.
I think every president's always done that. But
I don't know about that. I mean, usually they're giving pens away to other people.
I'm trying to veer wildly from national politics because I want to hear more about you.
My point is that you can't. We're going back to the reputation and the rightful reputation of the city, and why young people sometimes or other people are annoyed with that and don't want to be here or want to leave or don't want to come. I mean, look, I can't be responsible for other people's ethics or lack thereof. I mean, it's not something that I can control. I couldn't control anything that he allegedly did or didn't do.
But you perhaps undersell yourself as the essential one of the stewards of the Democratic Party in a city that has considerable power.
I have never been a committee person. I have never been a ward leader. I am not the steward of the Democratic Party. I mean, I am a Democrat. I love being a Democrat. I wouldn't be anything else. But I can't set policy for the... And understand, the Democratic Party of Philadelphia does not run under rules that government sets. They run under rules that they set for themselves. I mean, one of the things I think was unfortunate, and I would like to see change, but I have no power to change it, is committee people who are it's the most basic job you can have. It's a non-paid job, it's a volunteer job, you run for office in your neighborhood. Your neighborhood's called a division. So two people from the Democratic Party, two people from the Republican Party, they get elected to that spot. They actually are the people who elect the ward leaders. They went from a two-year term to a four-year term. And I think that has hurt recruitment of younger people, because if there's a committee person's election and you don't get into that race and then you want to get involved in your neighborhood in politics, and you say, well, when's that next committee person election? Well, it's 3.5 years from now. Well, I would wait 3.5 years to do this. But if it was every 2 years, I remember when I was first in politics in late 1970s, a committee person and ward leader elections were robust and they were very competitive. They're not so competitive anymore because people don't want to have a non-paid job where you get complaints from everybody in the neighborhood. I mean, it's like, why would I do that? My potholes, my trash can get picked up. This pothole's been there for 6 months. I mean, and they grab you on the street. And at least in the neighborhood I grew up in, people are very, they know who the committee person is and they grab them. So people, I think young people tend to come towards, gravitate towards civic associations, because they believe they're more democratic and they're more welcome than they are within the party structure. And I think that's why you see a lot of robust civic groups that have a lot of young people in them. And they themselves can be impactful in the election by voting. If you don't, look, I've said this before and I'll say it until I die. If you don't vote, it's crazy. If you think about what people went through in this country to actually vote, and you can't, I mean, we're not asking anybody to walk across the Independence Bridge. I mean, we're not asking anybody to get this head split open, but we're asking you to get off your couch and go around the corner to the library. That's not hard.
Is there another ask you have of the, I mean, I probably have 5 minutes, so I want to make use of this. Is there a call to action you would have of an educated, involved, perhaps civic-minded group of technologists and those around it? What can they do? Sure, vote. Is there something else you would want to challenge this group to be?
The question I have is, are they interested in politics? Is that not everybody's interested in politics. Everybody should vote.
And the challenge probably is it's cyclical, right? Sometimes when you see your DA go into corruption charges, you're like, why am I even going to get involved? And I wonder if you have champion.
That's the time to get involved. I mean, look at the turn. I mean, in this past general election nationally, look at the turnout. I mean, people were voting, and people will vote. Let me tell you something. People are going to vote in 2018, absolutely for sure. There's no doubt about it. I mean, and again, I don't mean not to get back into the Trump issue, but I if you saw that rally, or you saw the cuts from that rally in Harrisburg, what is going on? And I think 2018 will be a watershed election for turnout.
Let's rattle through a couple in our waning minutes here. Some of the initiatives that this community touches most include Startup PHL. That's both a call for funds and it has been matched investments. New fund manager. I don't know if there's any updates on Startup PHL generally you want to talk about or allude to.
There's nothing new.
Archie Sahai from Startup PHL, represented here, will be on our panel after the mayor.
You can ask her.
Okay, fair.
smart people.
She will be on our panel in a moment. Then we can ask that. But is there something at that top level idea of that being among your touch points? Anything that you would want this community to know about, or how you see it fits in your strategy?
I honestly think the best thing that I can do as a mayor is to set a tone in this city that juxtaposes what we hear on the national level. That cities can be and will be the salvation of democracy because we are diverse. And we do, and maybe not diverse politically, but diverse ethically and racially. And we have impact. Cities have, Philadelphia, New York City, Chicago, Boston, we have impacts. And we can impact the national conversation. And one of the purposes of my staunch Fourth Amendment support is that I want to make sure that people understand we still want you here. I want that Indian man who come up with that company. I want those students that are coming from around the world to study at Penn and at Drexel and at Temple and other places. I mean, if we were to just fall down and pay homage to this president and their ideas, why would anybody want to come to Philadelphia? So I mean, we'll fight, and then we'll figure out how we adjust and how we work it out, and what the courts do. But this has to be an open, progressive, welcoming city, or we're not going to be successful. And if you think you can play both sides of that street by being, rounding up people and handing them over to the federal government, and you think that's going to be helpful to you, and it's not going to be. It's going to give us a bad reputation with people who really are smart and want to live in cities and want to be innovators and want to start up businesses and want to employ people.
I have just about 2 minutes. One, and I want to shove two questions in this very tight frame. Is there something that you think your administration, you specifically, haven't gotten credit for, or you'd want to set the record on, something that you think that the message hasn't been out there?
No, not really. I mean, look, credit, what is credit, legacy? I don't get these questions all the time. What is, you want your legacy to be? I want my legacy to be less poor people in the city. That's a complicated legacy, but it's not, I don't view myself as that important in my own head. It's like when people say to me, "Your Honor," like the honorable. What are you talking about?
Just Jimmy from the block.
What the hell kind of title is that? I'm still not used to this yet. I'll go to a school and a kid will come over with a piece of paper and a pen, and I, yeah, what do you want? He says, "I want your autograph." I'm like, I'm not LeBron James. What do you want? Why do you want my autograph? But then I don't want to make him feel bad because I'll sign it. But it's still weird. It's like it's weird. It's weird. If somebody would ask me for my autograph. But as far as getting credit, let me tell you, the best thing you can do with mayor is give everybody else credit. That is the most important. If you can get people to believe that they're integral to the process and they're integral to the success of an endeavor, you can get them to work harder than ever. If you try to look at me, it's like I call it the Rosie Marie syndrome. Remember her? The woman who jumped out of the New York Marathon? Or Boston Marathon, she came out of the subway and got in front of the line, so she looked like she was winning. If you're that kind of mayor, no one's going to want to do anything for you. No one's going to do. If you're that kind of leader, no one's going to ever want to do anything for you. Like, get out of my way, I need credit. No, I usually push people to the middle. You get credit. It's every time we cut a ribbon or we break ground, the people who have worked for 10 years or 15 years to make that project actually come to fruition, I get that lady and say, here, take the shovel, you do it, because you did the work. And I think when you do that in a company or in a government, people feel better about doing working hard for the government, working hard for the company. I think the most successful companies in the world are collaborative, their CEOs and their leadership are down to earth with folks. They feel that there's a door open, you can come and talk to people anytime you want. And you're not going to be laughed at or ridiculed or penalized for coming up with an idea that maybe doesn't work.
So, final outgoing question. Really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being a part, and you continue to show up at company openings and events around this annual check-in during Philly Tech Week. We hope to continue. Is there something that we can hold you to? A year from now, is there something you want to see, a pledge, a promise, a goal, something that you want to work on that we can...
Because once you... we have set out a number of areas where we're working towards. I'm never going to say, by this date, we're going to do this. Because inevitably, if you fall short by 10%, you're going to get criticized for falling short by the 10%. It goes back to the DNC thing. You know, not the $230 million, it's the $130 million he didn't bring in. So I don't like setting those goals. And I do agree with Donald Trump on one thing. 100 days, it's like a stupid thing. Like, what, 100 days? What could you possibly get done in 100 days? Some of these things are so massive, you need maybe, you know, one or two terms to do stuff like that. But no, I'm happy, I'm content. I'm not happy all the time. I mean, you have to remember, when these events like this, like for example, the DNC was like one of the worst 4 days of my entire life. Because something bad's going to happen. Something bad's going to happen. And what am I going to say? How am I going to handle it? What am I going to do to the press? And it didn't. And then it's being Irish. And anybody's Irish, we always worry about everything, and then it never happens anyway. So we made no arrests during the DNC. That's unbelievable to me, considering the environment we were in, the protest environment we were in. And I'll just tell you the one, if you heard this before, I apologize. I'm walking, third day of the convention, I'm walking down Broad Street, I'm brought a moment, and I see a man taking a beeline across the street at me, and he's got a big Bernie shirt on. And I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And he comes up, and I must have had that look on my face, because when he got over to me, he went, what's wrong with you? I said, well, I guess I'm going to get yelled at about something. He said, no. I said, well, what do you want? He said, I want a hug. I was like, oh, awkward. Okay. I said, why? He said, because your police are awesome. I mean, they're not awesome. I mean, we have our issues. We need to deal with a lot of issues we have, and we're dealing with them. But when a protester tells you the police who are guiding the protests and keeping people safe are awesome, that's a pretty big compliment for a city the size of Philadelphia. So it's those kinds of things that that make my day interesting.
I believe that. Can we please give Mayor Kenney a big round of applause for being here? Thank you, sir. I really appreciate it. You're safe. You're safe. Yeah, you can. Mayor Kenney is going to be a faithful steward.